Bandwidth for Inside the Net is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is Inside the Net with Amber MacArthur, episode 23 for May 25th, 2006. Michael Geist. Hi, this is Leo Laporte. Welcome to Inside the Net. On this edition of Inside the Net, Amber talks to one of the most important legal minds on the internet today, Dr. Michael Geist. They'll talk about net neutrality, home recording, and many other issues that internet users care deeply about. I think you'll enjoy this interview. I apologize in advance for the sound quality. Skype was giving us a little bit of trouble on our recording date, but I think the ideas are well worth airing, and I'm sure you'll agree.
All right. Well, it's good to have you on the line, Michael.
And you, thanks for having me.
You are the chair of Internet and E-commerce Law at the University of Ottawa, and really an expert on internet law, which is probably a pretty interesting topic to chat about these days.
Yeah, it's been one of those areas that like started in this field, I guess, almost 10 years ago. And at the time when there was the boom, everyone thought, well, of course there's going to be legal issues. But in the bust and everything that's followed, certainly the legal issues that have arisen and the policy and regulatory stuff that comes alongside the development of the net has only increased. It's really it's one of those great areas where not every issue has been decided yet. So there's a chance not just to study the issue, but to participate and try to craft some of the rules along the way.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons that we wanted to chat with you is because the issue of net neutrality has been in the press lately, and there's so many other legal issues on the internet that have become really popular and have people, I would say, fairly puzzled. So the three things we wanted to focus on today, the first one is talking about music online and sharing of music. The second thing we wanted to talk about is video online, and I know that you wrote a really interesting column recently about video clips online and sort of the phenomenon of YouTube and what's happening from a legal perspective and also net neutrality. So the first question, I think this is kind of a broad question for you, but when people are downloading music or sharing music on the internet, I know they think, you know, they're unsure of whether it's legal to do so or if it's not legal to do so. And, you know, I'm kind of throwing it back to you because I still don't really have a definitive answer from anyone on that issue. And I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Sure. Well, I think actually it depends a bit on the country, and even within different countries, it's complex. Here in Canada, I think there's a general view amongst many that people that download, particularly people that download for non-commercial purposes, do so legally. So Canada has this system known as the private copying levy, where there's a levy on, or some describe it as a tax, on blank media, such as blank CDs. And it's generated a huge amount of income, about $150 million in Canada over the last few years. And that gives people the right to actually make personal non-commercial copies. And the law doesn't say anything about the source of that music. So it could, of course, be a CD that you've picked up in a store and you want to make a backup copy. But there's nothing in the law that suggests that it can't also be a peer-to-peer system where someone has made something available to you and you've downloaded it. The story's a little bit different, though, when we start talking about so-called uploading or, I guess, making available. And there's nothing, at least under Canadian copyright law, that would explicitly permit that. And that's true of most jurisdictions. So people who are putting full libraries of music online, sharing it for others to go ahead and download on peer-to-peer systems, are in all likelihood, in most jurisdictions, committing copyright infringement. As I say, the download side of the equation, though, varies from country to country. And I think in part that's some of the source of the confusion that people have as to where the law stands.
So, for instance, I've used before a program called Acquisition, which is a peer-to-peer program on the Macintosh that is similar to Kazaa Lite, which is a popular program on Windows to download music from other sources. You know, most people who are doing this think of that as being illegal if they're in Canada, but you're saying that that, in fact, you cannot be necessarily punished for doing that?
Yeah, I'm saying that it's certainly more of an open question in Canada. So if you are just downloading and you're not making those same songs available, I think you've got a pretty strong case that what you're doing is private copying and that the law already permits that to occur. I should also note, of course, that depending on the songs that you download, some of those songs may well be authorized such that you can go ahead and both download and upload. So when we talk about the illegal stuff, we're largely talking about the unauthorized copying, so the music that someone has ripped off a CD and they don't have permission to do so. But there is, you know, an increasing amount of music, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of songs that might be Creative Commons licensed such that the people are more than willing to allow others to go ahead and share that music or put out under other sorts of licenses where there is not a legal issue with respect to a person who's made it available. So it depends a little bit on the music that's involved, and then of course it depends on the jurisdiction and what you do with the music. And so as you can see, it starts getting pretty complicated pretty quickly.
So what about in other countries? We probably have the most listeners in the United States and then also a few in Australia and other countries. Is there any way you could just talk for a few minutes about the difference between Canada and the U.S. and maybe even Australia on the downloading side for music?
Yeah, sure. And so in the United States, there is not this equivalent of a private copying levy. And so I don't think anybody's tried to make the case that it's legal to download or upload in the U.S. And the reason for that, and the same would be true, frankly, for Australia, where they also don't, at least not yet, have a private copying levy. And so in both of those jurisdictions where someone does make personal copies, even though it's just personal activity, the law would likely treat that as an unauthorized reproduction of a work, an unauthorized copy, and thus an infringement. The lawsuits that we've seen against individual file sharers, and as you know, there's been literally, you know, nearly 20,000 of those in the U.S. alone, have typically targeted those that make the work available, the so-called uploaders, as opposed to the downloaders. But there would be nothing under law in the U.S. or in a number of other jurisdictions from stopping the recording industry from suing the downloaders as well, other than, of course, the common sense that this is just really bad for business and simply not having much of an impact on the amount of file sharing that takes place.
Now, what do you think the music industry is going to do about this, if anything? I'm sure you've had a lot of correspondence with them and just, you know, getting feedback from them, because I imagine they hate this. It's been going on for years.
Well, they certainly say that they hate it, and at least the large labels do. Although, interestingly, it's many of the smaller independent labels, who in a lot of countries represent the lion's share of the music that's created in those countries, aren't nearly as opposed to peer-to-peer file sharing. And that's certainly the case here in Canada, where many of the indie labels, who are responsible for about 90% of the music, Canadian music that's created, many of those are certainly not as strongly against peer-to-peer. And they recognize that for them, it's often obscurity or the lack of airtime that is their number one problem, not so-called piracy. And so peer-to-peer in many instances represents for them a fabulous marketing opportunity. They have a hard time getting radio play on conventional radio, and many of the ways that people find the music is actually through peer-to-peer services. And for many of the artists, that of course translates into significant commercial opportunities as well. There's a lot of artists out there who will tell you that about 90% of their revenue comes not from royalties on sales of music, but rather from touring and the sale of merchandise and the like. And in many instances, peer-to-peer represents a really terrific opportunity as a mechanism to increase some of those, some of the revenues that they generate from those sources. So I actually think that, you know, we tend to hear from a media perspective from the very large multinational labels who have made it their mission to target peer-to-peer. Yet my sense is that once you scratch below the surface, there's large parts of the music industry that are a little more ambivalent about peer-to-peer, recognizing that it has some significant benefits. And frankly, if there was a way to find some sort of commercial revenue stream from peer-to-peer, they'd probably jump at that rather than trying to sue it out of existence.
Yeah, so they're really, it's becoming more of a, they understand the promotional advantages to that because so many people are doing it and then going out and buying and going to concerts and becoming aware of the music. I would think it's, similar to some services that we've seen online and talked about, like Pandora, which is a music recommendations engine. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that at all.
Yeah, I know Pandora's great.
Yeah, it's really great. So, it's the kind of thing where it allows a lot of these indie artists to get out there and be heard when they don't necessarily have the avenue to do that if they're not part of a big music production company.
Yeah, I think that's true. I just want to jump in and note that while on the one hand, they've opposed peer-to-peer, I have to say the major labels are incredibly successful in at least creating the public perception that peer-to-peer is somehow responsible for the decline in sales that some of the larger labels have experienced. But I think that, it doesn't really stand up to much empirical analysis. I did a fairly lengthy piece in the online peer-reviewed journal First Monday some time ago, in which I took a look at the actual numbers, and what you find is that there are all sorts of changes that have occurred within the industry over the past 5 to 10 years, much of which have nothing to do with peer-to-peer. I mean, some basic things such as Walmart being the largest retailer of music in North America today, which has had a big impact on catalog sales because, of course, they carry far fewer titles than your typical large music store. A big impact on the retail price of music as Walmart wants to be a low-price leader. And then you throw in even the fact that DVDs weren't a commercial product at the time when Napster first hit the scene, and you find that there's an awful lot of reasons and a lot of new competition that the music industry is facing. And I think there are those that would even argue that peer-to-peer has been a salvation and actually in many ways helped stem the tide of losses as opposed to being a prime contributor to it.
Yeah, that's interesting because I know oftentimes I've been at cocktail parties or evening barbecues where people start talking about music sharing, and there's always those people who think, oh, you're stealing money from artists who are trying to eat and trying to, make money off their music for a living, and it's really not the right thing to do to be downloading the music. You should buy the full CD. I think you're right. The music companies or some of the bigger ones have done a good job of emphasizing that people should not be doing it, but it's the ones who maybe are kind of adapting a little bit or who are opening up and realizing this is the internet is a great way to share music who will end up coming out on top.
I think that's right, and we're seeing some of the best online music services moving in that direction a little bit as well. E-Music, for example, is now the number two online music seller, well behind Apple iTunes, but nevertheless number two, and they offer clean MP3s with no digital rights management attached. We're seeing other labels find ways to use even peer-to-peer environments as a way to promote their work, to try to find ways to use peer-to-peer bundled together with advertising as yet another kind of revenue stream. So there's a lot of opportunities out there. And certainly some of the artists are increasingly seeing that as well. We had in Canada just a few weeks ago some of Canada's best-known musicians, Barenaked Ladies and Avril Lavigne and Sarah McLachlan and the like, step forward and take a strong stand saying that the major labels haven't represented their voice in the past and that they would like to see no lawsuits against their fans and not using DRM, but rather finding new ways to leverage some of the technologies that we see out there today for the benefit of all, both their fans and the musicians and the record labels.
Yeah, that's happening a lot. I know there was a case a while ago, which you're probably aware of, in the U.S. where I think, there's been kids as young as 12 who have, there's been lawsuits filed against them for sharing music online, and a lot of the artists have come to their defense and said, hey, we don't oppose this and we don't want to get a bad rap because of this. So it's good to know that's happening more and more. Also, on the video front, I know that's something that you've written about as well, which is really interesting because there's so many sites and services that have launched, like YouTube and other services where people are sharing videos, and I imagine that's a whole other mess of an industry in the sense that you have everyone from people in Hollywood who are up in arms about the fact that movies are getting online as well as on peer-to-peer networks. So what do you think is happening in that space right now?
Well, there's the legal side and, of course, on the business side, and I'll leave the legal side for a moment. From a business side, I think the growth of this clip culture, whether it's YouTube or Google Video or, you know, the whole range of other services out there that make it very, very easy to share video clips, is just a huge story, both in terms of the amount of remarkable user-generated content. I mean, I think it's instructive that when you go to sites like YouTube, so much of the very popular stuff is not the mainstream media type created stuff, but rather individual stuff that, you know, is really finding a great audience. And I think it's very exciting. And while I think much of that was initially dismissed by some of the conventional providers, I think they're increasingly seeing that there is a market for it. And in fact, a lot of people are quite happy to spend some of their time looking at these clips and really interacting with these clips and find in many ways that they're more genuine than some of the marketed and manufactured content that I think some of the other providers seek to bring to the marketplace. When it comes to taking and using clips of some of the mainstream stuff that's out there, whether off television or the like, I think there's a bit of a love and hate relationship for many of the broadcasters and the content producers there. I think increasingly they're recognizing that this is just an incredible marketing opportunity. And so if you're a television show and you find people are sharing some of your clips, this is a great way to get more people to view your show. And of course, that will ultimately lead to more ad dollars and perhaps down the road more DVD sales. And even now, as we see more and more television shows being made available for purchase through iTunes or some of the MySpace and some of the other services, increasingly move people in that direction as well. But that, of course, hasn't stopped a number of the networks from trying to pull the plug on some of the video sharing that's out there. Sometimes it's to offer some of their own alternatives, and sometimes it's because they would seemingly prefer to die on a mountain and say that this is their copyright and they have the exclusive right to decide what happens to it, rather than taking what I think is a good business decision and saying this is a terrific opportunity that they ought to be promoting rather than trying to shut down.
So how do you think a big network like NBC or ABC or even some networks in Canada should deal with this whole issue of people putting their shows online and sharing them? What would be, you know, make good business sense in your mind?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's to run to the market and offer up those exact same shows. And they can do it in any number of ways, as we've seen, whether it's offering them through iTunes for $1.99, or as ABC is experimenting with a number of its shows by offering up for free a package together with some advertising in a streaming context. I think there's all sorts of ways to do it. And, of course, what that really means, I think, from a network perspective, is that you generate ad dollars the first time the show premieres. You generate increased revenue from the period after it airs for a number of months until the summer comes along, and then in the summer, of course, you resell all those shows again to your consumers and your fans through a DVD, and then of course then you relicense through syndication and the like. So I actually think this represents just the emergence of a number of new very exciting business streams. And while of course there is some of this clip sharing that's taking place, and I understand the concerns, I'd actually have far more of a concern if I was a rights holder with respect to the camcorder that are in the movie theaters and people who are taking some of this work and really reducing it to very, very poor quality and, in a sense, infringing on the moral rights of the creators. So the end product that users see is really poor. For those that are getting good clips and good views of what's out there, I think this in many ways will help drive people towards some of these new business models. And so in many respects, it's one of those things that you keep an eye on, but in fact, what you really do is provide the marketplace with a number of new alternatives, and I think many of the customers will gravitate there.
So insofar as video and any big networks, what are some examples of some companies that you think are doing it right and actually adapting?
Well, certainly we've seen from iTunes is now carrying a whole number of networks. I find that to be really one of the most remarkable stories, where a year ago, if you went to the Apple iTunes, and I should note we're talking strictly about in the United States right now, they're offering TV shows simply didn't even exist. And today, it seems like everyone's tripping all over themselves to offer up these shows, and increasingly season packages, so you get the entire season in one go. As I mentioned, the ABC experiment, where they're offering this up for free, bundled together with some advertising, is another interesting model. And in fact, I think the practical reality is that we don't know all the different ways that are out there. NBC is going to be experimenting this summer with a number of shorter versions of some of their shows, just smaller clips in a sense, while the show is on hiatus. And that, I think, reflects a growing recognition that the old way of offering up new shows from, say, September, October through May, and then taking the summer off, doesn't reflect the way people watch television anymore. And so by doing this with a number of shows, they're doing it with one show such as The Office, which I think is a really good show, and which is actually, it's a terrific show, and they've done a great job of experimenting with it, right? So they've found a real positive correlation, not just with, you know, trying to have a very full-featured website, but beyond that, an increase in the amount of viewership once they started offering up episodes on Apple iTunes. And so you get this nice symbiotic relationship where you get increased viewers on the actual on network night, which gives you more, allows you to charge more for advertising. At the same time, that drives more people to buy the product, whether as a DVD or a download, and you start getting into some new interesting experimentation. So there's a lot out there, and of course, it's really early days, and part of the thing that I think is driving all of this is a recognition from at least the television world that they can't stop this, and you know, the slogan that I think a lot of people are adopting is they don't want to be the recording industry. They don't want to be caught flat-footed while everyone's out there sharing clips and doing all kinds of neat stuff with the content, and they aren't offering the marketplace with a real alternative.
And I really like this idea of the clip culture, because I think that's entirely true. I was looking at Google Video just in the past day or so, and I noticed that all of the top 100 videos, I mean, most of them were 30 seconds to 2 minutes or 3 minutes. They're really not that long. So a lot of people are just watching these short clips online, and a lot of that video is amateur video, which we're seeing people do more and more, especially with video podcasting and video blogging. What is the best way for someone to protect themselves and protect their works online?
I mean, there are some who would argue the best way is not to put it online at all. I think in some respects you have to reconcile your fact to the fact that there may be some infringement. I mean, there are of course digital rights management technologies that allow you to try to lock down the content, but I think we've seen that they're terribly ineffective because they can always be cracked almost immediately. And beyond that, they create such a barrier between you and the people, your audience, the people you want to ultimately reach, that they only have significant negative consequences, I think. So putting the stuff out there and recognizing that copyright sure provides you with a whole assortment of rights, but you as a rights holder have to sort of do, I think, a more hard-headed analysis as to what's in your best interest. And if it's finding an audience and finding new kinds of ways to benefit, whether it's through advertising revenue or finding new ways to try to sell some of your content, I think the internet is really offers all sorts of opportunities to embrace it. And frankly, nobody's obviously found all the solutions yet. We're still very much in an experimental stage. It's really only in the last while that we've had enough people with even broadband connectivity that sharing video and the rise of the clip culture is even feasible. And in fact, I should note that, you know, the column I write appears certainly in Canada, but appears in a number of jurisdictions and countries around the world, including a number of developing countries. And I was actually trading emails, frankly, just today with an editor in Papua New Guinea, where they actually published some of my columns. And we were talking about the rise of the clip culture, and he was noting that the sad reality in his country at the moment is that there are so few people that have computers, much less the kind of broadband connectivity to engage in this, that this just isn't a reality in that country yet. So it's very early days, even in those places where we've got a lot of broadband. And so rather than coming in with tough legal rules that try to stamp this out and in any way prove to be ineffective, it's far better to embrace and experiment, it seems to me.
Now, what are your opinions on something like Creative Commons, where you can go in and you can try to protect your work? What do you think of people doing that who are putting video online or audio?
Well, I think Creative Commons is a great initiative, and I've been involved in the Creative Commons Canada side, where we've brought the license to this country. And the growth of that over the last three or so years, with literally tens of millions of licenses, I think it is truly one of the really exciting developments out there. And it, of course, does not replace copyright. It merely says, I think I was saying during our discussion, that from a copyright holder's perspective, yes, you have all the rights, but what you really have to do is take a closer analysis at the rights you really need. And I think Creative Commons provides a very simple and accessible way for all sorts of creators to do that and ultimately decide that they want to protect certain rights, say rights of attribution, which seemingly most people want to retain that right, that there's going to be attribution when someone uses their work, but are comfortable where their work is used in a number of alternative mechanisms, often without compensation. And I think it's noteworthy that we've had a couple of cases, at least out of Europe, where those Creative Commons licenses have been enforced, one in Spain and another in the Netherlands. So I think the licenses are certainly valid, and we've seen increasingly that they are a very interesting and often effective mechanism to allow your work to get out there, keep the rights that you need, but at the same time give people some of the leeway to use your work in all sorts of very exciting mechanisms that often the creator is very comfortable with.
So, you know, it's one of those things where you don't necessarily want to lock it down so tight that no one can access or use it anymore, because the nature of the web is really sharing and allowing people to experiment with that content and spread it around. And really, you know, it's more about number of eyeballs in some ways.
It often is, I think, for a lot of creators. And of course, there may be some creators out there that say that's not. You know, they simply want to be paid for their work all the time. But I think that, you know, we are seeing, I think, a real shift take place. And part of it is that you just have to take a look at the numbers. I mean, it's just there's so many internet users out there. And we talk about things like long tail and the like. And the fact that there is such an increased, there is now such a large market for all sorts of content and a market that will find your content, that if you are locking it up, whether through licenses or through technology, you're probably missing out on some of the great opportunities that are out there today.
Now, what about some of those people who, you know, want to kind of lock it up and they're thinking of charging, you know, subscriptions, and they're trying to make sure that other people aren't sharing their files in other methods? You know, do you think it's hopeless for them to try to do that? Should they really depend on advertising revenue from you know, sponsors and other people versus trying to get subscriptions because it's so easy to share files?
No, I think part of it depends, of course, on the kind of content that you have. And so if you've got a sufficiently exclusive amount of content out there that people are willing to pay for, then by all means, give it a try. And we've seen that, say, in the business publication area, where the Wall Street Journal has been very successful in selling subscriptions, and the New York Times a little bit less so, but of course has been making an effort in that regard. And while it's certainly true that there may be some slippage, so that, you know, the copyright is necessarily leaky, and even the technology is leaky, such that even if you try to lock it down, whether through subscription or otherwise, some of it is going to leak out. I think the reality is that for the overwhelming majority of people, they're going to still access your content in the way that you set up. So that if you've got a subscription model, most people are ultimately going to subscribe, or they might get a free trial, and ultimately they're either going to choose to become long-term subscribers or they're not. And so while there may be attempts to try to find that content in alternate ways, and of course oftentimes if all we're talking about, say, is an article or something like that, there are ways to go out and find it. Now, for the most part, I think the practical reality is that these business models still work, and the amount of slippage or the leakiness that occurs is fairly small in terms of the broader business model that someone might want to adopt.
Interesting. Another issue that we wanted to talk about, because I think you've done a great job, you know, just kind of explaining what's going on with music online as well as video online, is the entire issue of net neutrality, which is a little bit different, but I think it's an issue that's been in the press lately, and you know, you can't really go anywhere without seeing it. I know even one of my favorite video podcasts, Ask a Ninja, he kind of pokes fun at this issue in a recent episode. Can you explain to all of our listeners exactly what net neutrality is and how it can affect people?
Well, I can try, although, of course, one of the challenges around net neutrality has been that everybody offers up an entirely different definition, which is one reason they have so much trouble, at least in the United States, where there's been a lot of discussion around legislating around net neutrality, because no one can seem to agree on exactly what that is. But I think at its heart, we've had a pretty remarkable shift over the last 10 years, where about 10 years ago, internet service providers invariably wanted to compare themselves to common carriers like the phone companies. Essentially, you know, we have the pipes, you run it, you run your stuff on our pipes, we don't know what it is, and we don't want to know what it is. And there was very good reason for that, and that largely was because they wouldn't face any legal liability for the kind of activities that might take place on their systems. Well, you know, fast forward a decade, and many of those same providers have come to the realization that there's a lot of money potentially to be made if they start discriminating against different kinds of bits. And sometimes that's on the basis of the application. And so if we're talking, say, about Skype or a voiceover internet protocol service, where someone might say that if, you know, all of the ISPs are getting into the game of offering up their own flavor of internet telephony, and they say, well, it would be far better if we find ways to ensure that our service gets through, but we might either block or degrade the service of some of those competing services. And the same is true for some of the content as well, where they might strike, they either might be the originators of the content if they're a very large company, or they might strike deals with particular content providers such that they allow those content providers to ride on their very fast internet connectivity broadband networks. And for everybody else, or essentially anyone who doesn't agree to pay, they're stuck on the slow lane. And so we've started to see this in the United States in particular, where Bell South and Verizon and some other providers have started to talk about really almost a two-tiered internet, an internet that is very high speed, that can offer up, you know, sufficient speeds to allow for high-definition television, which is where some of these providers are going. And they say, well, we've got the ability to essentially sell that speed, not just for our content, but also for various websites. And the examples that are often brought up is that they might charge Google or Amazon fees to ride on that fast network and reach their customers in a much quicker fashion, whereas everybody else is stuck on the so-called slow lane. And the worry is that the people who are stuck on the slow lane will increasingly find that users gravitate, of course, to the faster speeds. And so if you've got one search engine, let's say, that's on the very fast speed and one that's stuck on the slow, users might gradually move towards the faster one because it's responding with search results so quickly. The same might be true, of course, for various e-commerce applications, booksellers, you know, you name it. People will generally start to recognize, if not immediately, over time, that one service has been very fast, the other is very slow, and they'll move, of course, to the fast service. And so what we've seen is a fear that this sort of thing might start occurring. And as I say, we're already starting to see it. And so there's been a big push for legislative change, at least in the United States, that would force providers to treat all content, whether they're talking about content or applications, in an equal manner, in a non-discriminatory manner, such that you wouldn't have the ability for the haves to essentially pay this fee and the have-nots to be stuck. And the fear is that, you know, while today we think of, you know, the Skypes and the Googles and the Amazons as the big success stories and the household names, the fear is that we don't know who the big success stories will be 10 years from now. And the Googles and the Amazons and the Skype have benefited from a network that has treated everybody equally. And to ensure that we get that next generation of success stories, they need to enjoy that same kind of benefit, a benefit where it's the best applications, it's the best services, it's the best content that wins out. It's not those with the deepest pockets who can afford to pay ISPs that ultimately emerges the winners.
Now, is there any case, you know, to date where ISPs are starting to actually do this, or are they restricted to not, you know, doing anything along these lines? How far along have they come?
Yeah, well, we've seen a number of examples. In the United States, we've seen instances where ISPs have blocked access to some competing VoIP services, so that they have taken positive steps, in one case, to block Vonage. So voice over IP is one place where we've seen positive blocking. In Canada, and I suspect in the United States as well, we've seen an increasing amount of traffic shaping, where ISPs, often with very little transparency, so they often don't tell you about this, will allocate an increasingly small amount of bandwidth for certain applications, very often peer-to-peer applications like BitTorrent and the like. And so that creates a real problem for some of those independent creators, the ones that we've talked about in this part of the clip culture, who will often look to services like BitTorrent as a mechanism to distribute their work. Same is true, of course, for a lot of independent software providers who will want to use peer-to-peer networks as a prime way of distributing their content and do so in a way that simply doesn't ring up such high bandwidth charges. And so if you've got ISPs that are shaping down the amount of bandwidth available to these sorts of applications, what you find is that those create a series of have-nots, people who simply can't distribute their content, whether it's software or video and the like, because people find that when they try to access it, their applications simply don't respond. And so these are the kinds of examples that we are starting to see, and I think that a lot of the debate around the need for some very clear legislative rules that guards against this sort of activity comes from the fact that we've just really seen the tip of the iceberg, and the fear is that we may see far more of this in the weeks and months months ahead unless legislators step in and try to provide some protection really for all parties, whether it's small businesses or consumers or in many instances big businesses as well.
In the case of blocking BitTorrent traffic, for example, I know this came up a while ago with Rogers, and a lot of its customers, I think I read this in an article of yours, complained. You know, do you think this is a case where the community or those people online will you know, fight back so much against this that it will be really hard for ISPs to do this?
Well, I wish that was the case. And, you know, I think the easiest solution to a lot of the net neutrality issues is competition. And so if there was a significant amount of competition for individual from an individual consumer perspective, I think the answer would be yes. I think that consumers could easily vote with their feet and simply go to another provider who would see that there's a great marketing opportunity in saying we don't do the sorts of things that you might find at some of our competitors. The problem that we have really throughout North America and, frankly, most of the world is that from a broadband perspective, there is still very limited competition. This isn't true for everywhere. There are places like Japan and the like that have pretty significant competition. But especially in North America, let's say, most internet users, and we're talking strictly of broadband here because it's important to recognize that when we talk about things like sharing video or using internet telephony and the like, it's only people with the high speeds that are in a position to do that effectively. And so for those people, they typically either have a choice of two providers or none at all. So they've got the cable provider or they've got the DSL telco provider, and that's usually about it. And frankly, in many jurisdictions, certainly the case here in Canada, is that even on the outskirts of major cities, you often find that they have no providers at all. So if there's no cable, Bell or the DSL alternative still hasn't come to market there. And while there is some hope that people have with respect to some of the alternatives that are emerging, let's say municipal Wi-Fi or satellite or broadband or power lines, none of those, I think, realistically offer, at least in the short to medium term, a viable alternative. And so I think you're quite right. Consumers would love to go to have another alternative. The problem is there is nowhere really to go. For the consumer that doesn't like what Rogers is doing, let's say they can go to Bell, but there's no reason to think Bell won't engage in precisely the same sorts of activities.
So is there anything that consumers can do right now to try to, you know, fight against this and, you know, just really try to, you know, let all of these providers know that, you know, it is a huge issue for most people and they won't want to use their services? Is there any type of online, I mean, there's so many things that happen online, so I imagine there must be some type of foundation that people are registering with or anything like that.
Right. Well, there have been a number of initiatives online, and part of it is to out the services themselves. And as I said, one of the real problems that we've seen with respect to particularly things like packet shaping is that there's a terrible lack of transparency. So that in most instances, internet users are not even aware of what's taking place. And in fact, say in the case of Rogers, there were denials from the company for a very long period of time until finally they owned up to the fact that, yes, they were indeed engaged in this. So one of the things that we need, I think, is greater awareness. And the internet, of course, is a great tool to be able to start sharing that information so that users become more aware more quickly about what they're doing. But at the same time, I think there is a role to play for legislators and regulators. So if you're in the United States with all of these initiatives right now around net neutrality, there is the opportunity to get out there and sites like SaveTheInternet.com that are really pushing for some legislative protections and to make your local congressman or congressperson or senator aware of your concerns. If you're in Canada, you can make our members of parliament aware of this issue as well. We recently had a very large review of telecommunications law in Canada, known as the Telecommunications Policy Review, who's got a 400-page document that talks about all sorts of regulatory reform. And one of their recommendations was providing a very clear statutory change where the law would provide for net neutrality, so no discrimination based on content or application. And if the government looks to move forward on reforms of some of our telecommunications laws, it's important, I think, to let our members of parliament know that it needs to include a net neutrality provision.
So I know that I promised that we try to keep this for half an hour, and I'm sure that you could talk for hours and hours about all of these different issues at hand, and I would love to hear it. But is there anywhere that all the listeners can go online to find out about issues such as music sharing and, you know, find out if it's, you know, legal on the download side or upload side, to find out about the legalities around the entire clip culture and video online, as well as net neutrality? Is there one site or maybe even your website where you keep up to date about these types of issues?
Well, certainly my site's one place that people can look to for updates, particularly from a Canadian perspective, but as we've discussed, increasingly international as well, and that's at michaelgeist.ca. On a lot of these issues, though, the dream is that there's one central repository, and of course there really isn't. It's almost becomes Google becomes the central place, because you go and you search it and you find a number of the different sources. But there's some great blogs out there, whether it's academics such as Larry Lessig and the like, who are regularly writing about these activities, or various groups that have formed websites or that are actively involved, such as Public Knowledge, which is very active on the net neutrality issue, or the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which has of course been very, very active on a whole range of online civil liberties issues. So it's very often the case that there isn't one central place, although I seem to get lots of email from people who wish they could at least answer just their one question.
but
there is at least... Well, you know, you try, but you try as best you can, but the practical reality is that there isn't, but there are lots and lots of really great sources that are out there. And I think even more importantly, there's the opportunity both to become informed, but also to become engaged, because so many of these issues are really still in flux, they're still in play. And there's an opportunity for a lot of individuals to make a statement and ensure that their elected officials, no matter where they live, become aware of their concerns and factor them in as some of these policies develop.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And for now, I'll keep on checking out michaelgeist.ca, because I know you have lots of great articles and information there for anyone who, you know, has questions about at least what's going on, generally speaking, in the news media about internet and the law, and from your perspective, because there's lots of great stuff there.
That's Dr. Michael Geist, the Canada Research Chair of Internet and E-Commerce Law at the University of Ottawa. For more of Dr. Geist's writings, visit his website, michaelgeist.ca. We thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next Tuesday on Inside the Net.